The following pod contains spoilers. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Baldwin.
What's up, Ray?
Have you heard of the Universal Asian?
No, what's that?
The other day you were asking me, like, where can I find Asian content, you know, hyphenated Asian stuff. You're Asian American, right?
That's correct. I am Asian American.
Well, guess what? The Universal Asian is an open platform run in a magazine style, and it's got a variety of things. It's got written articles, poetry, prose, and you might like this, photos.
No way.
Yeah, I know. And there's like so many photos on there.
I love photos.
Guess what? Asian topics are a little taboo. We, you know, like walking on eggshells, but Universal Asian, off limits. Anything goes. And people just tell their stories and they're so vulnerable and authentic. I think that's something that you would want to get into, right?
Yeah, that's great. It's always so hard to find Asian stories in media. So finding a place like the Universal Asian is great for me.
Yeah. And you know, they host online events, showcase what members are talking about. You know, they don't just provide content, but they also provide support through how-tos, discussions on topics of interest. And really, what you want to do is visit and subscribe theuniversalasian.com. You have Instagram?
Of course I got Instagram.
Yeah, I don't actually, I've never heard of Instagram. But I hear that you can follow them on Instagram. Go to The Universal Asian.
Sweet.
Yeah, join the Universal Asian community today.
Today.
Hey, folks. It's Alan. I appreciate your support by listening to our podcast. You know, there's a lot of effort and preparation that goes into each and every episode. It gives us the opportunity to talk about why these films may be important to us as Asian Americans. And you know, hopefully you share some of our feelings too. We'd love if you could come support our show by becoming our patron. By supporting our show, you'll help cover some of the production costs that comes from recording virtually and releasing our episode to your favorite podcast app. If you're able to support us, go to realasianpodcast.com/support and become a patron today.
When you grow up in an area where your friends are Asian, the food is Asian, and the culture you celebrate is Asian, you don't realize how the rest of the world does not look like you. Until a movie like Crazy Rich Asian happens and their stories are yours. They look like you and their family mirror yours. Then you realize your stories and realities were removed or conveniently whitewashed out of ease. We've come a long way, but there's still work to be done for our stories to be told and our lives to be represented on the screen.
Alan, thank you for that message. And also, go check out our Crazy Rich Asian episode if you have not yet.
Thanks, Helen. That's a great message. And this is exactly why, you know, we wanted to start this podcast, is to celebrate our stories and connect folks who have similar backgrounds so that we know that there is a space for us to discuss what we know and love.
That's right. So throw your Fendi bag over your shoulder and sashay away.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Real Asian Podcast. Here we have myself, Alan. We got Raymond, Renee, and Baldwin on the call. How are you guys doing this morning?
What's up, guys?
Hey, hey. I'm fully caffeinated with my Vietnamese coffee.
Oh, you got that café soda?
Nice.
Man, that's a strong way to wake up.
And that's a great point that Raymond started off with, because today we're excited, so excited to talk about one of my favorite films of all time, and that is Spirited Away by Studio Ghibli. Miyazaki's, in my personal opinion, his best film so far.
Wow. Okay.
And I, you know, we've been thinking about doing this film for quite some time now. I mean, my gosh, I first watched this film in high school, and I couldn't get over the fact that, gosh, was it so scary to me when I was in high school? But then I always left the film thinking, wow, what a magical journey that I've been through. What was it like when you guys first watched this movie?
I actually got a chance to see it in the theatrical release. Did anyone else?
No.
Nope.
So far back then.
Really? All right. Well, I was at the time 16, and I actually got a chance to see it at, you know, the Century Theater in Union City.
Union City.
That's the spot right there.
That's right.
Union City. Oh, my goodness.
I know.
One of the best theaters out there.
Union Landing, man.
And actually, it was one of a first date of mine in an ex. It just happened to become one of my favorite movies. Not because of the person, obviously, but I'm enamored by it. You know, I have a mural that I painted on my office wall of like Haku and No Face and the bathhouse in it. I mean, like, I just love the whimsicalness of it. I love the growth that you can be able to see. And just like in general, the different big arching themes between, you know, Eastern culture and Western culture and consumerism, environmentalism, you know, there's a lot of really great things in here to note. And I don't want to steal, you know, anyone's thunder, but basically, you know, being able to have the ability to have this character who was kind of whiny and felt like had no redeeming qualities at first,
for sure,
becomes like this
a little bit
cool, calm, collected person who really was like very sure of themselves, someone who was very caring, honest, open, and you know, I really appreciated being able to see the full 180, 360 kind of turnabout of Chihiro to send back to Chihiro.
Yeah. You know, right before we dive into everyone's first initial thoughts on the film here, for those of you who have been living under a rock, you know, Spirited Away is a movie about a story about a 10-year-old girl named Chihiro. She, you know, she inadvertently discovers a spirit world in which she and her family are lost, and her mom and dad get turned into pigs in this spirit world. And, you know, Chihiro must learn to fend for herself as she encounters magical and fantastical spirits in this world. You know, she's on a journey not only to save her parents and bring them back to the human world, but also to, more importantly, learn who she is, learn who her true identity is, and what makes her special in this world. And that's what makes this movie so powerful and so memorable and has so much of a cult following for those who've watched the film. Baldwin, what are your initial thoughts when you first watched this film?
So I watched it in high school as well. I didn't see it in theaters, but I remember that it was such a huge movie and I was kind of like intimidated at first to see it. And then when I did see it, I just loved it so much. You know, to me, Spirited Away is definitely a masterpiece. Just the way it blends fantasy, Japanese mythology, a very intricate story with some universal themes and interesting characters. And then coupled that with the production elements, like the animation is just so beautiful and so is the music. And it has a lot of very important messages and the Eastern themes in the films that we'll talk about later. But they're integrated so seamlessly into the story and everything's layered with so much meaning. I think it's just amazing how Miyazaki can take aspects of real life, conceptualize them into the movie, and then bring them even more to life in a way that just grabs a hold of your imagination. It just whisks you away on an adventure. So I think it's a brilliant film, and it's a classic in my book.
Can I confess something to you guys?
Let's
hear it.
Go
for it.
It was actually my first time watching it this week.
Oh, oh no. My goodness.
Shame. I didn't.
Rap heads, please don't disown us for this.
Oh my god! Card is revoked.
I didn't want to say anything because I wanted your guys' raw reaction, so I know how you really feel.
What the hell?
Dishonor.
Vicky didn't have you watch it back then.
I mean, I've heard of it. I just never got around to watching it, so it was my first time watching it this week. So, but okay. Overall, though, I thought it was beautiful. I mean, I expected nothing less from a Miyazaki film, knowing that from Princess Mononoke, knowing the accolades that this movie got and all the praise that you guys have been saying. I don't think I could have really expected anything less. But, you know, anytime people were talking about Spirited Away, I just kind of went along with it. But I never confirmed that I watched it. I was like, yeah, yeah.
Totally. Oh, my God.
Okay, how many girls did you try to convince that you've seen? You're like, yeah, yeah. Girl power, yeah. For sure. Yeah. You're like, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like,
yeah, no face.
Totally.
You're like, yeah, yeah, the ghost, the black ghost.
that one character.
The black face ghost. Yeah. Oh my God.
Oh my
no,
God.
No face, not black face. Come on, Ray.
Oh, man. But overall, my quick take on it is if I'm using Princess Mononoke to compare, especially because it's fresh in my mind since we did an episode on it really recently. Go check it out, by the way. Always got a plug. If Princess Mononoke really was a display of Miyazaki's masterful storytelling, Spirited Away to me was really his display of just like limitless creativity and imagination, because there's so many characters, that fill up this world, this bathhouse, and this spirit realm that, you know, you would think it could risk losing its audience with just everything, because, you know, there's just so much going on, but it doesn't do that. Like, the focus does stay on Chihiro and her journey. The side characters in the bathhouse do just enough just to color the world of the movie, but not too much where I feel like I have to invest in so many of them. And really, they just enrich the scenery. But basically, if I had to really summarize this movie in one phrase, it's literally expect the unexpected, because everything is just out of this world. Like, when I was watching it, I was just like WTF the whole time, but like in a delightful surprise, like the big baby, the talking door knocker, Kamanji, No Face, the stink spirit, all of it was just wow.
You know what, Ray? Wow. I wish I could be able to see it through your eyes the first time again, because it's such an instant classic.
It really was.
It's interesting because of the fact that it did have a theatrical release. That meant that the Eastern themes were, you know, didn't scare away basically the audience to actually make it so that they Spirited Away became one of the top grossing Studio Ghibli movie.
You know, I also wonder too, like, you know, you guys watched it when you were younger, where your mentality is a lot different than as an adult.
I was in college.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
I think for me, like, I had to not really force myself, but get myself to appreciate like the childlike imagination and innocence of the story. I think if I was watching it as younger or a teenager, I would have bought into it like immediately. But it was just a little bit different for me as an adult.
It's interesting you say that about having to suspend disbelief, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're like, oh, it's so fantastical and all of these crazy, you know, mythical themes and things like that. Yeah, I can see where you're coming from.
Because I think we're so used to being so logical all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just like a mode that we're always on.
And that's what's great about this movie. It forces you to pause everything and then brings you to a fantastical world. And I think that's why, you know, Baldwin, you and I watched it when we were in high school, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, totally. Me too. Yeah.
Right, right.
To our listeners, Raymond did.
We'll just get that part out.
But that's what makes this movie so great. When I watched it as in high school and then now as an adult, like, there's a sense of gravity that sucks you into this world. And then when the movie ends and it releases you back to the human world, don't you feel like a sense of like, wow, that's a lot of stuff off my shoulders? But you're just like, you just had this magical journey. Her parents, unbeknownst to this entire journey, are just like casually walking back to the world. And then you just left this fantastic journey where Chihiro had to earn her name back and discover who she really was and become such a powerful character. And it's such a great metaphor to how people grow up. You have this amazing journey, and then next thing you know, boom, you're able to be proud, or you're able to be strong and in your own skin. That's what's really great about this film. And, you know, speaking of themes in general, you know, Renee, you brought something up about environmentalism. And Raymond, you talked about how this film, there's so many things going on, so many characters that fill this world, but then it's so easy for you to concentrate on what Miyazaki is really trying to discuss in this movie. And so, Renee, you talked about environmentalism. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Ray, I think you brought up a good point about talking about Princess Mononoke, because that also has a lot of environmental themes. One of the biggest themes was the stink spirit coming in. That was actually one of the obstacles that Chihiro had to face as Sen, where she basically was able to acquire these bath tokens and use these really expensive, luxurious ones on this customer that they actually saw as not someone who was even worthy of it. But she saw something different. She saw that there was something better in this stink spirit that came through.
Great scene.
And so, you know, while she is going through and scrubbing and doing the scunt work, right? Like, she doesn't want to, but she chooses to be a respectful worker. And she can tell that there's something wrong with it. And at first, you just think, okay, it's a thorn, whatever, or maybe something. But you don't realize that this is actually the crux of what made this spirit become this decayed, smelly, awful thing. It was because it almost forgot who it was until she helped them. And when they finally start, everybody in the bathhouse finally starts coming through to kind of come together to heal, to clean, to whatever, right, the spirit, then they're all rewarded with the ability of saying, like, hey, you cared about this spirit. It was actually a river spirit. You pulled out all of this junk from within it. And, you know, because of the community work, right, we were all able to benefit from it. And so, you know, I think that's one of the biggest themes in the fantastical world of the spirit realm in the bathhouse, that anything is possible. And I really wish I could relive that scene again, because it was filled with all of these roller coaster aspects of it. Like, oh no, is she going to drown? Is she going to get consumed by the spirit? Mm-hmm. And all these different things. But she actually rose above it to be able to meet that challenge. And I really feel like that another thing to be able to say to her and her spirit is that she's someone who rose to the occasion. And I loved seeing that growth in her.
To go more into the roots of the philosophy behind it, for those of you who don't know, Japan has a heavy, heavy emphasis on conservation and the sacredness of nature. Mm. And it's very rooted in their Shinto religion, which emphasizes respect towards nature and how humans need to live in harmony with it. And we can definitely see that message in the film, especially with that scene you described, Renee, how humans' pollution of the environment and carelessness can cause so much damage in the world. And what's really interesting about that scene is actually the real story behind what that spirit was based on. I don't know if you guys have heard that story, but Miyazaki said that there was a time when he was a part of a team that was cleaning out a riverbed, and they pulled out tons of trash from it, including that bicycle. But afterwards, It was super clean, and fish actually returned to it. It's not just showing us the consequences of human pollution, but also the fact that we can actually repair the damage that we create if we just try.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I love that, Baldwin. I actually wanted to touch a little bit more on the Shintoism aspect of it. You know, one thing is that Shintoism is the belief of, like, everything has a spirit, from rocks to trees, to forest, and the water. And that aspect of it, of taking care of your environment around you, is because it actually goes to helping, you know, maintain balance and order.
Yeah.
There is something similar to that in the Hmong culture. You know, as animists, we also believe that there's a spirit in everything as well. We also don't really believe in the fact that we own anything, because it, you know, it belongs to nature. And so, you know, I really resonated with that aspect of it culturally. And it was really beautiful to see that represented on film.
Yeah, Miyazaki said he believes that in Shintoism, how everything has life to it. And if everyone adopted that kind of mentality, they would think twice of raising down forests to build apartment complexes, which is pointed out in the movie,
so
right?
True.
There used to be a river, but now there's, you know, apartment complexes. And so if we adopt this philosophy, maybe we can be a little bit more considerate of our environment, of our natural world, which is also seen in Princess Mononoke in that sense, as well, illustrated as well as them literally being gods and spirits. Alan, quick question for you. If you were Sen and you were trying to tie the rope of the bicycle, which kind of knot would you have used?
Honestly, the best way to really do it is tie it with a figure eight so that it's really secure. And then you want to do like a trucker hitch on the other side to pull it out. That's the best way to do it.
Was that what you were thinking?
I was like, I don't know. She's like, I was like, Sen, you gotta do better than that. What the hell are you doing?
Those rock climbing skills.
You know, it's funny you three brought that up, of how the film really emphasizes environmentalism. And then it's funny because you could see the evolution of Miyazaki's thought process and how he thinks about environmentalism and consumerism and materialisticness nature of the human behavior in his films. You saw it really displayed in Princess Mononoke, where it was the physical embodiment of human greed in the film. But here it's a little bit more subtle. It's about focusing on environmentalism and your own power within, how you can live with that type of dichotomy. So, you know, Baldwin, in your notes, you talked about consumerism, materialisticness. And it's funny because that's such a huge theme in this movie that plays really well with environmentalism. Can you share your thoughts on that? Because I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just like pollution like we talked about. It's gluttony and overconsumption, materialism in general. Like her parents...
Like, I want to eat everything.
Exactly. her parents turned into pigs after eating food that they weren't supposed to eat. And yeah. Everyone in the bathhouse is just so obsessed with gold and money and even food. So I really think it's sort of alluding to the carelessness of humans and how destructive it can be. You know, one thing I really liked about the movie is that these messages aren't so explicit and in your face. Like, it's not so preachy. Yeah. The messages are woven into the story as metaphors and allegories that have these hidden moral meanings behind it. And you don't really notice it until you look deeper into the layers of the movie. Like, me watching it the first time in high school, like, I never would have thought of these things. I was just engrossed in this world. It's not something I think you can understand as a child, but as an adult, you could appreciate it a lot more. And I think it's really brilliant just how Miyazaki has all these random little scenes and parts that just pile on to this, the theme of overconsumption, gluttony, materialism. Is just all combined together to make you feel like deep inside.
Yeah. So I guess someone wrote a letter to Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki wrote back kind of explaining why he had that scene where her parents turned into pigs. Mm. And according to Miyazaki, he says there were people that turned into pigs during Japan's bubble economy of the 1980s, how humans became so greedy. And he says these people still haven't realized they've become pigs. These people are the ones saying we are in a recession and don't have enough to eat.
You know, and it's funny that we talked about this because the scene when No Face eats the frog, right in the halfway point is when the film begins to pivot, because the first half, you know, Chihiro loses her parents to greed, obviously, and then there's a period of self-discovery, earning her way in the bathhouse and making a name for herself. And then right at that half mark of the film, it's like an hour and 5 minutes in, that's when No Face begins to throw gold at everyone. And then you see how greed consumes the bathhouse for the entirety of like the next 30 minutes or so, and how that plot so heavily relies on greed. You know, you see the positive side of greed where it can be, you know, beneficial for the entire community. But then you see that a gluttony of that automatically reveals that folks really don't want a excess of greed because it can ruin the bathhouse in and of himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are your guys' thoughts on how he so strategically pivoted the themes of the movie? It was like discovery, amazingness, and then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, this is actually really bad. What are your thoughts on the halfway point of the movie?
At first, honestly, when I was watching it, so fresh eyes, no, I didn't know if No Face was going to be a good character or a bad character. Maybe it's not as binary as that. And I honestly was kind of like, maybe it's a good character because I know Renee had No Face on her wall. So I was like, why would she put up a bad character?
I also painted the Makuru Kurusuke or the soot monsters as
I love
red.
It. I love
so they look like, love so they look awesome. Like... Well, they look like coronavirus on my walls.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
That's okay. Those things were first before the coronavirus arrived. It's okay. I think for me, so I found that Miyazaki included No Face to actually help speed up the plot. So originally, the movie was actually like 3 hours long, but he had to like cut it down. For me, what I really found about No Face is it represented sort of how people are consumed by the environment. So No Face kind of mimics the personalities and behaviors of, you know, the conformity of what society is and his surroundings, right? You see with the bathhouse, when the workers are portraying greed and they just want all the gold and they're eating and everything, No Face is like this destructive manner. So it's kind of like a reflection on society. But put No Face with Zeniba, where it's a little bit more of a nurturing environment, caring aspect, like when he's spinning the wheel, I forget what that thing is. No Face becomes a valuable asset. And so I think it just kind of shows we become the product of the environment that we surround ourselves with.
Mm-hmm. So is Zeniba the good witch or the bad witch?
I thought she was bad at first and then she turned out okay. I don't know.
Compared to your Baba... she's got to be the good witch, right? That's what I think.
Yeah.
I would argue that there's no good or bad witch. I think between Yubaba and her sister Zeniba, they're both on a spectrum of good or bad, but there's no necessarily good or bad. Very similar to Princess Mononoke, right? I think what makes these films so powerful is that there's so much nuance in every character. Because at the end, you know, although Yubaba was sort of crass and rude to Chihiro, she does honor her contract, although she does have to make him guess and guessing her parents. but like that's what makes these films so great, is that there's no inherently evil character. And what Yubaba's character represents is, you know, she, at the end of the day, she has to run a bathhouse. She has to try to make a profit because it benefits the spirits who live there. And then, of course, she does have to recognize that she wants the best out of them. And so she recognizes that Chihiro, or Sen, plays an important and pivotal role in this. And so she's happy to bring her along and show her the ways, because she recognizes that although she's a human in this spirit world, that she could provide a lot of value to the world. And, you know, speaking of the value to the world, I'm surprised that you didn't watch this film before, because, you know, Spirited Away and No Face is all over all lo-fi playlist artwork, you know.
I know.
And, you know, I want to talk about the music, because, you know, one music that I love from Spirited Away, and I remember I Napstered this when I was younger, was, it's called One Summer Day. It's the main theme of Spirited Away.
Joe Hisashi is such an amazing composer. And the way that he draws in the beautiful melodies and harmonies of the piano and the swelling music really instantly becomes classics, because of the fact that you already, when you hear just a few key notes and you're already whisked away into this fantastical world. I would just play, his albums even without the movies, just because it was so relaxing, cool, calm. And you can always kind of feel transported back into wherever that moment in time was for you based off of his music.
Kind of reminded me of like an RPG game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that'd be freaking epic, right?
I mean, the whole movie kind of reminded me of an RPG game.
It really does.
I mean, with Joe Hisashi, like in that soundtrack, I used to listen to like all of Hayao Miyazaki's movie soundtracks all the time when I was younger, like, just as I'm studying, it's so soothing, and it's almost like a lullaby kind of, right? It just brings you, centers you into this world and calms you down and takes your mind off to like a fantastic space where you're not worrying about some of the common responsibilities you always have in day-to-day life. So, I mean, I just think it's really amazing how Joe Hisashi is really able to capture the essence of Spirited Away in the movie, and how it really transports you to another world.
I think when I listen to the soundtrack, it's funny because I also listen to it without watching the film too, is, you know, the animation where you have the rolling fields of grass, the flowers as Chihiro's running through the fields with what's his face?
Haku.
Good God.
Don't forget him.
Very similar to Yaku. as she's running through it, the music of One Summer Day, it makes me feel as if I'm lying down on the bed of grass in the summer and then just a light breeze rolling through. And I think that's what Miyazaki does a great job at. You know, we talked about how he makes his films. He doesn't do it traditionally where he writes a plot and storylines and storytells it. He draws images and then he tells a story surrounding it. I mean, just quick notes about the film itself, but how do you think his way of making films, where he draws the pictures first, then he writes a story around it, how do you think that affected the movie? And how do you think that made the movie better or worse?
Oh, that's a really good question. Can I go back one little bit? One little click. I love what you said about the rolling hills and drawing that imagery. There's actually this portion while riding Caltrain when I used to live in San Mateo going into San Francisco.
Oh, I love it.
I would always, you know, most people are on their phones, but I'm always staring off out the scene. I just love trains in general. Mm-hmm. And there's this one piece where it's just all this water when you're passing by Millbrae. And I always feel, because like the train and then the water is right there. So I always feel like I'm on that train in Spirited Away. Ray has no idea because he never watched it before, and I'm sure you haven't taken mass transit since. But basically,
Caltrain, what's that?
I always feel like I'm captured in a Miyazaki film when I hear the Joe Hisashi soundtrack playing, and I just feel like totally in my feels. I'm in that moment of being whisked away to a fantastical world.
You know what? It gave me the feelings whenever I listened to Zanarkand. Woo, I love that song.
Man.
Yes.
Oh, nostalgia.
Yes.
Oh, Final Fantasy X, the best Final Fantasy. Anyways.
Agreed.
Can you guys play? I can play that melody on the piano, actually.
Oh, really?
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, man.
You should do a rendition of that and we can change our intro song.
There you go.
I love that. Yeah.
Put it to some lo-fi beats, too. Yeah. I'm going to do that.
Thanks for the idea.
You know, I wanted to talk about what our favorite scenes are about this movie, because at the end of the day, this is a film that's pretty freaking hilarious. And so I'm going to say my favorite film is when No Face is in the bathhouse after he eats the frog. And oh my God, he becomes a fat ass and starts eating everything. And he's consuming things. And he starts off with the, I want to eat everything. And this is just all over Tumblr, all over college posts. It's hilarious. What are you guys' favorite scenes here?
The big baby was very interesting. I was like, play with me.
The ass crack is everywhere.
Yeah, and the ass crack is everywhere. Mm. He's like, I'll break your arm if you don't play with me. I'm like, oh God, my worst nightmare. and then Yubaba. I mean, she's terrifying. She kind of reminds me of Jigo from Princess Mononoke, honestly.
Actually, yeah.
It's the wart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My favorite scene, there's several. I think one of my favorite scenes is when Chihiro climbs onto Haku's back and they go flying through the air. Mm-hmm. It felt like a dream, and it kind of seemed like that because the very next scene did look like she was just waking up. So, you know, she thought it was like, was that just a dream? And she comes to realize that she still has, you know, that medicine ball or whatever. Right. So, you know, I think that, that sequence, I'm sure I've dreamt of things like that too. So I really enjoyed that aspect of it. It really made you feel, you know, like in your feels. And then probably another one is one that's like super highly memed, where basically No Face is on the train tracks and then he gets like hit with this huge splash of like a wave. And so I've seen people put the word feels all over those waves. And just like hitting it with just all in your feels.
I actually really love that train scene too. I feel like it's such an iconic scene because for one thing, like what it represents, like when Chihiro gets on it, she's just sitting there and it gets emotional as she's riding it. She seems to be kind of like leaving her innocence and her childhood behind, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like with most movies, like that scene will just go by in a split second. You just show it and it's gone. But the way that Spirited Away allows you to sit with these characters and their emotions, it just makes you sympathize with them more and empathize with them. And I guess like just connect with them a lot more. That's how I felt.
So much said with no dialogue.
I know
that's true. I also like how when she does confront No Face when he's asking for her and she gives him the little dumpling thing, so he starts yakking. He's like, mm-hmm. blah, blah, and but oh, God. I like how like she comes up and she makes all these amends and she's really piecing everything and putting everything together and providing her own resolution. And what I think really I like about Chihiro or Sen is contrast that with San or Princess Yutaka. She's the reluctant hero, right? She's Ashitaka kind of assumes this natural leader position. Chihiro, not so much, but that's what makes her so relatable, is that she could be any of us.
Yeah. This is a bit of a tangent, but Ray, you mentioned it. Do you guys notice that there's so much throwing up in this movie? Like,
many
people. There's a lot.
Like the river spirit, No Face, and then even Haku like throws up his curse. And like, I thought it was weird at first, but I also thought that maybe it's trying to say something, like the concept of purging mm-hmm. these negative qualities within yourself, right? More specifically, things like greed, manipulation, all those negative aspects about yourself. Because usually after they do that, it's like they feel a lot better, like they healed, right? So I just thought that was interesting.
So just take your medicine.
Or just put your finger down your throat.
And just throw up everywhere.
Speaking of the opposite of throw up, though, okay, if you were at those stalls with those delicious food, wouldn't you also gorge on it too?
I want to eat everything.
They were going
in. Ghibli films are known for having beautiful displays of delicious food. I know that I wanted to eat everything.
Imagine a stall, though, at the end of your meal. You get slapped in the face.
I know, yeah.
Like, that's just the ending of the service. Like, thank you. Boom! Yeah.
That's a real cleansing of your palate.
I'm kind of into it.
Yeah.
that, guys, we'll take a quick break and then we'll see you guys in the second half.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods often shared with family but don't fit a plant-based diet. The journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annie'steacakes.com to place your order today.
Hey friends, for those that really know me, know that I love picnics. But not just any picnic, I'm talking all-out, fancy, make-other-picnics-around, jealous kind of picnics. However, it does take a lot of time and effort to put these picnics together, and for some reason, none of my friends ever want to help out. Gosh, that's why I go to Experiences by K. Experiences by K is a Bay Area luxury picnic business that can be set up just about anywhere from the beach, park, your backyard, and more. Simply go to the website, book your picnic, show up, and enjoy good times with your friends, worry-free. Great for birthdays, anniversaries, proposals, you name it. Go to experiencesbyk.com right now for your upcoming occasion and check out Experiences by K on Instagram at Experiences by K. And now, back to the show.
So, you know, in the first half, we talked about the overall themes of the movie, environmentalism, consumerism, materialisticism, and the grand scheme of the movie. But we wanted to take a step back and talk about one of the pivotal scenes in the entire movie, which is the bathhouse. You know, Raymond, you actually have some really good thoughts on the bathhouse itself. And, you know, why don't you kick us off here and then I'll have the roundtable of folks here discuss what the bathtub means or the bathhouse means to us in the world.
Yeah, you know, bathing culture and bathhouses, or called sento in Japanese, have deep historical roots in Japan. So it's a key component in Japanese tradition. So much so that nightly baths are really a beloved tradition in almost every Japanese household. When I noticed that, you know, this whole movie primarily takes place in a bathhouse, you know, my first question was like, what's the significance there?
Getting naked.
That too. Miyazaki tells a story of like when he was at a bathhouse, there was this mysterious door that no one ever entered or exit out of that at least he saw. So he's always kind of wondered like what was behind that door. It could have been, you know, the Wonderland or something like that. But usually in order of seniority, family members often soak in the bath after washing, after like actually washing and cleansing themselves to relax and to end their day. And, you know, bathing is not exclusive to Japanese culture. It's really how they view bathing and how it's interwoven in the fabric of their society kind of makes it really unique. I found that the earliest manifestations of bathing culture is accounted in Lee Butler's 2005 article, Washing Off the Dust, Baths and Bathing in Late Medieval Japan. So community baths laid the groundwork to later developments of sento and onsen. And sento is just the man-made structure of a bathhouse, and onsen is like natural hot springs. Community baths have religious and therapeutic origins, focusing on like the purification aspect of it. And really it was for like the elites, and kind of did open up to charity baths for the poor located in Buddhist temples. So there was a deep emphasis on the connection between physical cleansing, but also like spiritual cleansing in bathing culture. Around the 14th century is when the early signs of commercialization appears in Shinto that's related to bathhouses. So I guess there was records of Shinto priests generating revenue for the shrine by way of penny baths, which I assume is what they charged a penny for a bath. Mm-hmm. Or it could have been baths full of pennies. Who knows? That could have been a thing too.
I would love to show you that.
That'd be wildly uncomfortable. Leslie Wynn from the University of San Francisco writes, hot water has long been viewed in Japan as an all-encompassing natural remedy. So bathing culture also includes healing effects. The natural springs were once reserved for samurai, Buddhist priests, and locals. Nowadays, it's called balneotherapy, which is basically where the heat and minerals of water are believed to have physical and psychological benefits that can treat numerous ailments. So bathhouses are also very integral to its community. So communal bathing has always been a place of social interaction in its earliest years. Wynn states, the public bath was not just a hygienic facility, but also a vital social institution where natural daily gathering would happen, where there was like a full range of neighborhood business that would be transacted. There were accounts of bathhouses being used as like a place of sexual services, you know, so where the bathhouse attendees were, attendants were all female and offered extra money for a little extra, offered extra for a little extra. However, actually, the Japanese government banned mixed gender bathing in 1657. And some historians believe it's because of the culmination of a very long campaign dating as far back as early 18th century. Some historians also think that another strengthening of that legislation really came about during American occupation post-World War II, because, you know, they probably saw these bathhouses and immediately thought like, ooh, okay, prostitution. But, you know, I think statistically, historians believe that prostitution was more of an exception to the rule. So they very hold dearly like the sanctity of bathing culture. Nowadays, Sento has evolved to adapt to modern demands of its patrons. So there's this thing called Super Sento, where bathhouses can be multi-leveled, high-tech, and like offered a wide variety of theme baths. There's like Russian ones.
Jesus.
And, you know, Chinese ones.
Sento Plus.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. You know, but ironically, you know, even though bathhouses today tend to be marketed to attract new customers and to reflect a changing demographic, they are still seen as important aspects in Japanese culture. And for one Japanese national to still partake in bathhouses or communal bathing is to really connect with his or her cultural identity. And so that's what I found about bathhouses.
Ah, interesting.
Mm-hmm. So has anyone been to a bathhouse?
No.
No, but I'm open to it now.
Right. I mean, I think this is a post-COVID activity for the rap heads, or for us, you know what I mean?
All right. Well, then I'll meet you guys in San Francisco at the Kabuki Bathhouse then.
Ooh. I've been there. It's lovely.
So there is a co-ed time, but it is, but you have to wear clothing for that.
Right.
The non-co-ed is clothing optional, and those are my favorites. So just walk around nude, basically.
The non-co-ed is clothing optional, but highly discouraged.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Ray, you talked a lot about the physical healing properties of bathhouses. And as I was researching it, I learned that in Shintoism, the significance is pretty symbolic, and it's that mankind purifies themselves of the pollution that they've caused, both in the environment and the pollution of the negative attitudes and the hearts within oneself. But even if you don't buy into the whole spiritual aspect of the cleansing, it's still a very symbolic ceremony, because going to a bathhouse, it's like it's rest and relaxation, right? You're supposed to feel a lot better afterwards. And part of that is just de-stressing and getting yourself in a better mood. So the spiritual meaning behind it is internalized by a lot of cultures, especially Japanese culture, when you go into a bathhouse. And I mean, if it really does affect your overall well-being, I'm all for it. So
what's also really interesting, what I found, is the contrasting, you know, view of just bathing. Like, I don't take baths. And I think just the idea, especially in American mentality, it's go, go, go. And so when it comes to cleansing, it's like, I want to take the quickest shower because I have to go somewhere. But for Japanese culture, it's like at the end of the day. And so I want to take a bath to like signify that I can relax and stuff like that. The interesting thing, and if we were to relate it back to Spirited Away, though, I think there's also a commentary that Miyazaki makes is that this bathhouse and this bathing culture is meant to symbolize, right, relaxation, healing. But the bathhouse in Spirited Away is kind of a madhouse, right? It's a business. It's a place of business. Right. So I think Miyazaki is also kind of saying, like, there's this duality, you know, he sees within bathhouses. It's supposed to represent traditional values, but at the end of the day, it's a business, and there's commercialization of it. And so where do we fall between those lines?
Right. Mm-hmm. How far is too far when it comes to bathing? So I love the baths, but as far as cleansing goes, there are some really wacky ideas out there, such as like there's one where you can bathe in red wine. There's one you can bathe in coffee. There's one you can bathe in a bowl of ramen.
That's a UTI waiting to happen there.
Those are just gimmicks, obviously, but there's many different types of bathing. And, you know, and it's definitely not just centered around Japan. There's many different types out there. You know, Koreans also have a very healthy bathhouse.
That
kind
is
of,
true.
Where it's like multi-level. There's even areas just for kids. And like they basically spend a whole day there where they're eating, drinking, watching TVs, lounging, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I actually really savor the idea of being able to slow down. And so, you know, I recently bought a house, and the main reason why is because it has a gigantic tub. And
nice.
And I, truth be told, I haven't had a chance to take too many baths in it. But, you know,
well, you need more ramen packets. That's why.
You do.
Ramen baths. But, you know, I love taking out my, my deep sea bath salts and filling my tub and
there you go.
Being able to, you know, to be able to purify and cleanse. Because it really helps to de-stress, especially yeah. You know, those higher temperatures. It really help to kind of get the circulation going and help with aches and pains and recovery for sure. And things like that. So ultimately, personally, I feel like I love the idea of being able to incorporate the aspect of cleansing, of slowing down, of being able to have community within these houses. And, you know, for the longest time, it was actually looked down upon to have tattoos and go to a Japanese mm-hmm. bathhouse because of
really?
The association with Yakuza.
And only yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But they only recently started lifting those bans, but it's still kind of frowned upon. But if they can tell that you're not like Asian or Yakuza, then, you know, like they kind of give you a pass, but it is, you know, like, you know, decency and things like that. It's so funny because it's like they don't mind you walking around in the nude, but you have a tattoo and it's like,
oh Lord. it's like alluding to when Christians see like gay people, like what, like super hardcore Christians. They're like, what is this? And then, but then they're solely fine with like divorces and getting married again,
right.
Divorces
exactly.
And getting married again.
So contradictory.
I know, right? Unbelievable. Speaking of bathhouses, I wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to deep dive on Chihiro herself. Obviously, this movie centers around her discovery, her journey through the bathhouses and the spirit world. But, you know, when I got a chance to watch this movie again for like the umpteenth time, I took away from the movie that Chihiro is someone who's trying to learn her identity, learn who she is. And the bathhouse is that vehicle by which she has an opportunity to discover who she is. She is thrust into like an unknown world and a world that focuses on cleansing, the idea of a community aspect, albeit with spirits. And she has to combat all those unknown factors while at the same time knowing that she has to save her parents. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of a bathhouse represents a cleansing and then discovery and then community. Also portrays in the film that it is Chihiro's journey. The bathhouse is her vehicle, but which she can have all those aspects and then grow as a person. And so that's what I took away from her being so focused on the bathhouse for the first half of the movie. And then the second half, she continues on and meets Zimbabwe. And then continues
Zeniba.
Wow, I just matched up her sister.
Zimbabwe.
She went
to Zimbabwe. And then she took a train to Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe. But like the second half, after she learns and discovers everything, she goes and journeys off to herself after acquiring all those skills via RPG style and then saves her parents. What are your thoughts on Chihiro?
It's definitely a coming of age story because we see Chihiro go through such a transformation, like you said, Alan. Over the course of the movie, in the beginning, she's very much a child. She has the luxury of doing nothing and having no responsibilities. And when we first actually see her, she's riding in a car. She's like upside down, chilling, complaining to her parents. And, you know, later as we go throughout the movie, even when she starts working, she clearly has no idea what she's doing. There's several scenes when side characters are like, have you ever even worked a day in your life? Like, and we see that with Chihiro, like she's even afraid of being left alone by Haku. Yeah, like you said, Alan, once she's thrust on her own in the bathhouse without having anybody to be her caretaker, she eventually becomes brave enough to take these things head on, and she gradually does the hard task of cleaning the stink spirit. She treats everybody with kindness and respect. That's why, like, all the side characters are sort of endeared to her, right? And all that hard work is what transforms her into a stronger character who's capable, and she can handle things on her own and all of her own problems. And, you know, the great thing about this movie is that she didn't need to find some sort of mystical object to transform her or anything, right? Yeah. Like, she had it within herself to do these things to her the whole time. It's when she accepted the responsibility of saving her parents and also Haku that she starts to make that effort and finally encounter some tough obstacles and handle them with maturity, really.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, in the end, she's a completely different person who can appreciate the people around her, and she's more hardened by her experiences. I think in the end, even her dad says something like, school is going to be scary for you. And then she says that she can handle it with a lot of confidence.
Child labor. That'll mature you up.
Baldwin always with those mic drops.
I know. That was so beautiful, Baldwin. I go hard, guys. Thank you so much.
Going, you know, kind of catapulting off of what Baldwin was saying about side characters, Kamaji actually shows that what he was one of the first ones to kind of go out of his way and make a case about giving her the ability to even just survive there in the spirit realm by, you know, telling her what she needed to do, and the fact that she did what he said, right? He didn't give up. She didn't give up. She made sure to press the fact that she needed to have a job there. And then Lynn is also another main character, side character that kind of main character, who really also sticks her neck out for her and kind of treats her as a younger sister.
Lynn is human, right?
I think she's a spirit.
She's a spirit, but maintained her human form based off of what they said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was like, there's another human here.
Well, Haku is human, takes a human form too, so.
Oh, yeah.
She looks human, but not necessarily is.
Right, exactly. And, you know, so like Lynn also is someone who basically helps her to grow. And you know, one aspect of Lynn that helps her become this kind of, that Lynn becomes this conduit of growth, is she trusts Chihiro or Sen to be able to do these hard tasks when she goes off to go on the train, things like that, right? She believes that she can be able to do it, and being able to, use that belief in this other person really kind of made it so that Chihiro also believed in herself as well. So, you know, it was really interesting to be able to come across these supporting characters that really enabled Sen to be able to figure out who she is again and, find her name.
For me, Chihiro really represents the attempt to reconnect with your past, for her trying to, like, almost forgetting her name. But then sometimes it's like you need to be able to understand or appreciate your past, but it's not going to be the same. She's trying to reclaim it, but it's not going to be the same. So at the end of the day, the lesson is you need to look to the future. You need to be able to grow. Yes, you can appreciate the past, but you can use it to guide you into the future. And that's kind of like the journey that I see with Chihiro. And she just knocks tasks down, challenge after challenge. She's like able to overcome
dropping
buckets, picking up coal. I mean, first of all, the way that she picked up that coal, terrible form. I mean, just the worst deadlift form. I was like, Chihiro, you're going to hurt your back. You got to lift with your legs, tighten your back.
There you go.
Deep breath. Yeah. So it's like, for me, what's interesting is I watched Spirited Away and then I watched Spider-Man Far From Home.
What?
So similar.
I was catching up on movies. Stick with me here.
Weird transition.
The crux of Far From Home is that Peter Parker wants to just be a teenager, right? But he has this mantle, and going through the Infinity Saga as an Avenger, a lot of people are looking up to him, and spoiler for people who haven't seen it, but a lot of people are looking up to him to be like, are you going to be the next Iron Man? Who's going to be the next Iron Man? Who's going to be the next Cap? Peter Parker just wants to be a teenager, but, you know, there's a certain level of responsibility that you have to assume, and that's what Chihiro has to undertake. I mean, She literally embodies, with great power comes great responsibility.
Oh my God. There it is. I was waiting for that mic drop there.
So Chihiro, Peter Parker, same people.
Exactly. That was about to say. It's funny that we talked about how the bathhouse allowed her to grow into herself and what her true identity was. You know, I think the overall theme that wraps up this movie is your identity and your name. Because there's a line in the movie where Haku is saved, and then Haku, where he talked about, you fell into my river. You were the one.
Okay, is that a euphemism? That's what I'm thinking.
That's a euphemism for a lot of sex.
Oh my God.
Way out there.
It's like when you go out and you're like, hey, let's say you and I fall into some river. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. We got some slip and slide here going on.
The innocence is like totally taken away from this movie.
But that's what Miyazaki focuses on. He treats no one with kid gloves. This is all in.
the call me by your name reference actually makes a huge amount of sense now.
Oh, God.
she's like, I want you to say it, Haku. But, it's great because...
Baldwin.
You're ruining my childhood, man. My experience is further away.
My cheeks are all red.
I'm just kidding.
It's like, oh, that's what it means to say I want to eat every. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, it's like I want to wrap this up, this segment up at Chihiro and her pretty bow is that, to our listeners, I think that's what makes Chihiro such an amazing protagonist is that, she didn't need some magical sword or something to discover who she was. She always had it. She just had to find it in herself and have these journeys of self-discovery, perseverance, for her to really show the world who she really is. And when she comes back to the human world and her dad's like, it's going to be scary for you. She's like, bitch, I just fucking fought off a whole bunch of shit and I had to save your ass from becoming pigs. And so it's just a way for her to say, I'm a strong person and I don't need anyone else to tell me otherwise. And that's what I love about Chihiro. One thing that Miyazaki does so well, and he's really well known for, is that he doesn't storytell the traditional way. He doesn't write plots and then continue with it. He draws an image. He paints something that's in his mind, and then he tells a story around it. How do you think that affected this film?
For Spirited Away, he used a little bit more of the computer technology that was available at the time, but not necessarily to lead with that because he's an artist naturally. So he did most of the drawings, but he used the computer technology to kind of enhance the details. There's this one interview that John Lasseter did. He's the executive producer of the English version. And he says there's this part where Chihiro, when Haku wakes her up and tells her to meet her at the bridge, she like leaves through the boiler room and she like puts on her shoes. And that level of detail to where most animators would say, okay, well, you just kind of see that part. She would just her feet would go immediately into the shoe. But if you watch it again, you can see it toes in first, but then like the back of the shoe gets smushed, right? And then she has to like actually fit it in and use her hand to like actually put on the shoe. And he's like, most animators would not do that. And as animators, whenever they hit a brick wall and of just creative, block, they would watch that and watch Miyazaki films to really inspire them a little bit more. So that really enhances the experience.
That's interesting.
I love that.
Absolutely. I was going to say that every scene pretty much is a still that you could be able to print out and frame it because of the mastery that went into it, from the color compositions to the actual, rules of three, just like to, all the, this, every single piece of it, there's such care to it.
Yeah.
And really it is there's this aspect of mastery in 2D animation, frame by frame shots, that you lose out, and that magicness in when it's a 3D rendering. So if you guys haven't seen the Studio Ghibli movie, Earwig and the Witch, it's on HBO Max, and you just lose all of that appeal of what makes Studio Ghibli movies wonderful and fantastical. It's these nuances and stopping to go ahead and slow down and be able to fixate on the shoelace, on, on the way that a piece of dirt rolls away, things like that.
To the surface level watcher, it may seem a bit discombobulated because there's no cohesiveness. But then I think the beauty of storytelling in this particular manner is that it allows you to fill in the gaps with your own thoughts of majesty. There's so many particular key pieces in the artwork where Miyazaki focuses on wanting to tell a central theme with a specific picture. So when anything, like in the bathhouse, he drew all those images, right? And then he thought to himself, well, what does this scene supposed to tell me? And then he drew that, and then he told the story surrounding it, and then he began to branch out further out. I think what makes it beautiful is that he is able to show the artistry and the mastery of how he's able to control the story through visual storytelling. So that's what makes this so beautiful to me. It's very different from how stories are typically told in film, but it means that every single image tells 1,000 words.
With today's technology, we have animated movies that look very realistic and advanced with the CGI, but there's just something about 2D anime that just hits different, right? Like, Spirited Away is definitely more of an anime. It brings these subtle, realistic aspects to life that we normally wouldn't notice, like how movement is captured, because you could take any frame in the movie and the things in the background are so interesting and you normally wouldn't notice it or expect it to be there.
Going into our final segment, you know, we all love Studio Ghibli films. I want to talk about power rankings. Mm-hmm. And so I want to go into top five Studio Ghibli movies. And, you know, I'm going to start off because I know mine very, very easily. And this might be a bit controversial. So coming in at number five is actually Castles in the Sky. I know it's pretty beloved, but it's not that great to me. Number four is My Neighbor Totoro. Three is Kiki's Delivery Service. Number two is Princess Mononoke. And one is Spirited Away. Spirited Away mains the top at my power ranking here.
Okay.
Mm. Renee, how would you rearrange that?
Yeah, I'll go next. So I think your ranking is pretty good. I would take out five and put in Nausicaä. Nausicaä is actually one of the first movies that came out, and it also has a lot of environmentalistic themes. They normalized face masks, and so, you know.
Yes.
How apt.
I felt it was really topical. and then I would... Neighbor Totoro was so good, but I'm going to have to put in Howl's Moving Castle for number four.
Okay, so I like all the movies in your guys' selection. There's just so many to choose from, right? So many that are so iconic. I don't know about the... Number two is definitely Spirited Away, and I'll explain what my number one is. But from three to five, like, I put in My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke, and Kiki's Delivery Service. But number one for me is Howl's Moving Castle, for sure. Mm. It just has this, like...
Wow.
It's a personal thing. It's, like, very sentimental to me. When I watched it, it just, like, really took me away. I really connected with the characters. The fantastical elements of it is just amazing. This is weird, but I even named my first car after Sophie.
Did you really? Nice.
Yeah, I know it's just weird, but I just, like, love the characters in that movie. It's so heartwarming and really just brings you to another place. So Howl's Moving Castle, definitely top of my list. It's one of my favorite movies of all time, actually.
Did you get a chance to see that in theater, too?
No, I didn't, and it sucks because it was, like, re-released in theaters, actually, and I never got the chance to see it. One day it'll come out again.
I would say my top one, I think the movies are amorphous. They can kind of go around, but top one for me, honestly, is Princess Mononoke. I like watching that again. Just the theme of how it so connects to today, and it's just perpetual in terms of its meaning and relativity. I was like, man, this is really good. Now, Spirited Away is really good too. I mean, again, it was the first time watching it. So I enjoyed it as just a really, really good film, animation film. But Princess Mononoke, for me, it's got the epicness of it. Just, you know, and I wanted to be Prince Ashitaka, the cool guy, and just
with the shirt off, where he's like kicking
with
down
the shirt
that thing.
Off. Exactly. And I just, you know, loved how the wolves and the spirit gods and all that stuff. And so that's number one for me. I'm not gonna argue all the other ones.
I feel
I'm flexible with everything else.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. And thank you to our listeners for listening and tuning in to our episode about Spirited Away. And we hope to have you join us again for our next podcast episode on the Real Asian Podcast. Thanks again, guys.
See you guys.
See you guys. Hey guys, thanks for being avid listeners to our show. If there's a movie out there that you really want us to have a take on, feel free to let us know by sliding into our DMs on Instagram at Real Asian Podcast. And if you want to support the show, feel free to go to realasianpodcast.com/support.